a brutal bloodbath. The Prime Minister took the axe he's been swinging through the public service and turned it on his own ministers, bringing it down on Broadcasting Minister Melissa Lee and Disabilities Minister Penny Simmons, both cut and Lee even hiffed from Cabinet.
This is really about making sure we have the right people on the right assignment at the right time.
Putting all his ministers on notice.
You're going to see me continue to do this. This is how I roll, this is how I lead.
The opposition having a field day.
The new government has been in office for only 6 months now and the wheels are falling off already.
Absolute sense of chaos.
But a question Christopher Luxon really needs to ask is, why stop there? You've had Shane Jones and David Seymour criticising the judiciary. A minister in my government did that and they had resigned from their relevant portfolio the same day that it happened.
The week had started far calmer, the government picking off some of the low-hanging fruit in its quarter two action plan, reversing changes made under Labor, bringing back three strikes.
Our goal here is to incarcerate violent offenders.
There's no evidence to suggest that it actually reduces violent offending.
And making it easier for banks to lend cash.
We all remember the stories about banks going through people's KFC receipts and Netflix subscriptions. The 11 pages of extremely prescriptive requirements is being scrapped.
I do think that we need to watch out for the devil in the detail.
And politically painful for the PM after police and the government were forced into arbitration last week because pay negotiations hit a stalemate. Now resident doctors too have hit a pay impasse and plan to strike.
We value our doctors tremendously. Health New Zealand are obviously in a negotiation with the resident doctors in particular.
And finally, the gangs came to Parliament.
It was capital punishment. And so even death wasn't deterring people from committing crimes.
Joining a near unanimous chorus of public submissions critical of the government's bill to ban gang patches and gatherings.
It is a limit of freedom of expression that is unjustifiable.
Considering whether these may impact on children, it doesn't appear to us that there's been enough consideration of this issue.
The Police Association, one of very few submitters offering support.
You can't arrest your way out of it, but there has to be multiple ways of dealing with it.
Kia ora Aotearoa, I'm Tova O'Brien. Welcome to the pod. In a compelling and unusual case this week, the Children's Minister took the Waitangi Tribunal to court and won. As my colleague Glenn McConnell reported from the High Court in Wellington, the long hearing saw comparisons to former South African President Jacob Zuma, ex-UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and the Watergate case, where ex-US President Richard Nixon tried to fight a summons. All told, 15 lawyers gathered to argue about the case. It was in response to the minister, ACT's Karen Shaw, being summoned by the Waitangi Tribunal to give evidence about her plan to repeal Section 7AA of the Oranga Tamariki Act. It's the part of the Act which requires Oranga Tamariki to take the Treaty of Waitangi, Te Tiriti o Waitangi, into account. A lot of it centres around Māori children being placed with whānau, hapū and iwi. ACT says it creates a conflict between protecting the best interests of the child and race-based factors. It's created political drama too, with New Zealand First and ACT making comments critical of the tribunal. Shane Jones called it a star chamber, and David Seymour suggested it be wound up. The Prime Minister told them to effectively pull their heads in, saying their comments were ill-considered, but Seymour, he bit back telling Stuff, quote, "I'm surprised to hear this. If you have a concern with another leader's comments, you should raise them directly rather than through the media, which is what I now intend to do," unquote. Take that, Luxon. The PM says they've now had a deep and meaningful conversation. Chaw is fighting the summons, which the Crown says is a coercive power that the tribunal has never used against a minister, and that senior Oranga Tamariki officials have appeared, which is sufficient. But the tribunal says the only person capable of properly explaining Chaw's reasoning is Chaw herself. Lawyer Annette Sykes is planning to appeal the High Court decision, so it's not over yet. But let us return to the heart of all of the squabbling. Section 7AA. Tracy Martin was Children's Minister when the law took effect. The former New Zealand First MP and Minister joins us now. Kia ora, Tracy.
Nice to see you again.
Really nice to see you too. Can you start by just, for our audience who may not know, explain what Section 7AA is?
So Section 7AA was an innovative piece of legislation that was put inside changes to what was the Child, Youth and Family Act that then became the Oranga Tamariki Act. And it was put there because everybody recognised that Māori children were overly represented in the number of children coming into the care of the state, that we needed to change the way we interacted, the way that the system worked with those families of those children. And we needed to be able to ensure that it was actually happening. So 7AA requires the chief executive to create relationships with iwi, hapū and whānau, and to report on those relationships, basically, at the end of the day. It has one other thing, which is that it was also recognised in legislation that children knowing who they are and where they come from is really, really important. And, in a Māori context, that's whakapapa and whanaungatanga, and knowing who you are as a full person means you must know where you have come from.
So it doesn't categorically say whānau first, but it insists that Oranga Tamariki takes that into account, that the children know where they're from and that they have connections with their whakapapa, hapū, iwi.
Yep. It basically says that we recognise that who you are, your culture and your history is important, that the state maintains either your understanding of it and if in the best possible world, connection to it.
And you were the minister in charge when it came into effect. How do you feel about Section 7AA now?
Well, the same way I did when I was the minister. I personally think it's an enlightened piece of legislation. Ann Tolley was the minister at the time who introduced the legislation into the House. And there was a piece of work done back in the 1980s called Pōʻau Te Atatū, which was, even then, Māori children were in the care of the state more than any other children. So that piece of work is what Ann Tolley was trying to implement and get the state to change its behaviour to deliver, which means that let's work with the families and the hapū before they are in crisis and before we have to take their children away for safety. Let's actually start to support them. And that's what she was attempting to do with this piece of legislation.
And so what then do you make of the fact it is now being, we'll come back to the fact that it was legislation introduced by the National Party and passed under the National Party, but what do you make of the fact that it's now being repealed?
And again, I'm sort of at arm's length of this. I'm only hearing the same thing that everybody else hears on the news and so on and so forth. But it does seem to me to be, it appears to me to be a lack of understanding. There is another section of the Act, I think it's 4AA or 4A, that refers to whānau being the first port of call. And I remember when the legislation was introduced, quite a lot of speeches from Labor and the Greens with regard to the removal of family first, because it's not in there. So 7AA is not actually about family first. So there seems to be a conflation of those two things. The second thing is that there does appear to have been, for example, I think they're called reverse uplifts, which is a strange little way to describe something, but there does appear to have been a few times where this piece of legislation has been used by perhaps an overzealous social worker to uplift a child that has been established in a foster parent relationship to return them to their family, and that has caused angst.
And there's one really significant case which has come to the public attention that Newsroom reported on, four Tamariki Māori who were taken from a violent home. They were put into a Pākehā foster home, a forever home, the social worker had told the children at the time, but then 2.5 years later, after Section 7AA came into effect, the children were reverse uplifted and taken to live with whānau that they didn't know. So doesn't that prove Act's point, I suppose, that there are unintended consequences with the law?
I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing to say, that is not what this particular clause in the legislation was for. And one of the places where this particular all the information came to create 7AA actually came from the children in care. So this was something that was important to them. However, I've also sat across the table from young people who have asked me, why did you give me back? Why did your organisation give me back to my father who was still violent and still drinking and that? So we don't get it right all the time. And sometimes we do have overzealous individuals inside our workforce. But I suppose if I was sitting there, I would be thinking, is there another way to get the outcome we want rather than take away something in this legislation that has actually lowered the number of children coming into care by over 2,000 children because it forced a relationship with iwi and hapu much earlier on to do prevention and early intervention.
And I might be putting you on the spot here because you haven't been in the ministerial chair for a while, but how common are those reverse uplifts?
Well, in my time, I actually never had a reverse uplift hit the headlines. So in my time, I would have had to say that they were uncommon. I remember having quite strong conversations with iwi leaders around the should a Māori child be with a Māori family. And the number of iwi leaders and elders that said, no, the child needs to be safe in the first instance. And Ngā Iwi, for example, from Ngāti Kaununu in the Hawke's Bay, they did it. They fixed a similar challenge in a different way. They whangaed the foster family. So they adopted the foster family into the tribe, which made them all whānau, which meant that it was much more of a whangai sort of a relationship without removing the children. There's always another way, I would suggest.
And I'm looking at one Waitangi Tribunal report here, which talks of a 2022 review. It identified 16 cases between 2021 and 22 where a change was considered for children placed with non-whānau to be returned to whānau care. But only about half of those cases were the children actually taken from the non-kin carers and given to whānau. So this kind of reverse uplift situation. So we're talking about around 8 cases over a one-year period. Does that, to you, warrant a repealing of that piece of the legislation?
Well, there's still 8 cases, so there's still 8 children that we're talking about. So if we're actually putting children at the centre, then you can't answer a question like that based off what is a series of 8 cases. I don't know how long the children... Often when we uplift and assist in a time of crisis, because that's really the only time you go in and you take a child out because you have to use the emergency powers, it's because they are and you've deemed them to be in an unsafe environment, they're in danger, and they're placed with a foster family immediately while you go and find the family that can look after them. And if you can't do that, then you know, a long term. So you would need to know in those 8 cases, was this a short-term placement while family group conferences were held? You know, grandparents might have been found, or aunts or uncles, that then the child was taken and placed with. I would need to know the details of each aid case.
So let me put it a different way then. To your mind, will children in state care be better or worse off if Section 7AA doesn't exist?
I personally believe that children will be worse off if 7AA doesn't exist. I believe it puts a responsibility on the chief executive to ensure that there are, one, relationships with iwi and hapu who are better placed. They are on the front line. They are better placed to go in as soon as there is a call of concern, which is when you should go in with prevention and early intervention. And also that the current funding of the workers who ensure that the children's history is always recorded for them, there would be no justification for that if 7AA was removed. So children would lose that required connection to who are they before they went into state care.
So Oranga Tamariki, like all government departments, facing cuts. 9% of its workforce is looking like it could go. That's 447 jobs. Could that compromise the work that Oranga Tamariki does?
My concern would be that what Antoli was trying to do, the operating model that I put into place, what we were trying to do was to shift from a crisis service to a prevention service. We were trying to stop leaving our families to get to the stage where we had to uplift their children by investing in them much earlier when we saw that there was trouble. And this is the social investment policy that Bill English envisaged when he also championed this. So my concern would be that by having an outside accounting agency come in and say, how can we cut money for you and how can we cut workforce, is that they go back to just being a child crisis service. We have to change to supporting families in need before the children become at risk, before babies are killed, before all these other traumas happen to them. And that would be my biggest concern.
And the government said that it's not their cuts aren't going to affect frontline services, but there was a report and stuff this week that because of the hiring freeze, there are no lawyers in Gisborne and Southland. They've been left without lawyers. Are lawyers at Oranga Tamariki frontline to your mind? Because they're working directly with families, aren't they?
Well, they are. If you consider that the state cannot take children, uplift children, without the legal right to do so. So there has to be a level of evidence that says this child is in danger, we're going to do one of the biggest things that the state can do, and we're going to go into that family and we're going to uplift children. I would have thought you very much wanted lawyers to be there to make sure that what is the appropriate level of evidence, and is there any other way we can do this before we go and do something that is so invasive by the state on a family. The other thing is, I was just talking to you before about those individuals who are employed inside Oranga Tamariki, to make sure that we track down the history and keep hold of the history of all children, not just Māori children, all children who are in the care of the state. So those are maybe considered by somebody who doesn't understand the purpose, they might be considered a nice to have. But actually, if we want to try and break the cycle of what we see, which is children being in the system, then having children in the system, we need to change the way that we have done everything up to this point.
What are you worried that these cuts might then do to the work that you and Antolly before you set out to do?
Well, I would worry that we will just change back to a child crisis system. And that's too late. The damage has already been done. Children have already been traumatised. Babies have already been killed. We need to shift this up. So that would be my concern.
And you mentioned as well that, so Antolly was the minister responsible for introducing this legislation, passing this legislation. And she did that. The National Party did that. And we both read her speeches at the time. She really proudly passed this legislation, proudly passed it with the support of the ACT Party.
Mm, yeah, that's right. And strangely enough, New Zealand First, who I was the MP for at the time, voted against it. It's an interesting way the world works.
And New Zealand First voted against it because, and I suppose it speaks a bit to ACT's argument now, not then, but ACT's argument now, that there wasn't enough clarity around where the priority of the legislation sat, whether the priority was around whānau first or whether it was around the safety of the child.
Yeah. Derek Ball was the lead on that at the time. And if I recall correctly, there's also an increase of the age around youth justice.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I think New Zealand First had an issue at that time around the increasing of the age of youth justice, if I recall correctly, but it's been a while since I did that speech.
What do you make of the fact that the ACT Party and the National Party are kind of spearheading the repeal of this thing now after they so emphatically supported it in the first place?
There's been a churn of human beings inside both of those parties. There's been a churn of human beings inside Parliament. So some of your sort of historical knowledge, I suppose, gets lost. But it does sort of go to the impression that I have that there's a lack of understanding or a lack of, I'm going to use the word understanding, of what 7AA actually does, how the numbers and the success of it with regard to Māori children in care, and clearly identifying the problem. There's a problem. I'm not trying to say there's not a problem, but trying to work with the organisation to come up with a different solution that might get washed out at select committee. But it does make me think that perhaps they're not very aware of what the history of this was.
Do you think also it's perhaps become a bit of an easy political red button race issue?
I don't know the individuals well enough, because I would prefer to actually know people before I decide that's an extreme statement to make about them. I don't know these individuals well enough. I know David Seymour, and I to some extent, and he's a very David Seymour's, strangely enough, probably one of the most honest politicians you've got in that parliament, because he says exactly what he means and he believes exactly what he says.
Except that back in 2017, he was saying he really believed in 7AA by putting, he was the sole MP for the ACT Party at the time, right, by putting his name to this piece of legislation.
So, yeah, so it does, it is an interesting turn of events. My personal view is that the benefits have outweighed the negatives, and perhaps there should be another solution to the negatives.
And it's not the only piece of legislation, is it, or the only thing that you've been proud to spearhead as a minister, which is now being undermined by a government of which your former party, New Zealand First, is a part of, is it?
No, you're quite right. As the Associate Minister of Education, I was responsible for the launching of the health and sexuality curriculum, which New Zealand First particularly has highlighted during its election campaign and also during its negotiations with the government. I guess my comment on that would be, it's been, 4 years since I introduced that that curriculum. It was new. Everything that's new should be reviewed after a period of time. We shouldn't just let things sit there. I do believe there has been a problem with implementation. I don't believe there's a problem with the curriculum. It's not ideologically driven. It's basically just saying we should respect people for who they are. However, some of the way that has been implemented inside our school system has been odd. So I do think there is an opportunity to do better. There's always an opportunity to do better.
So this, for people who don't know, the guidelines included increasing awareness around sexuality and gender diversity, and then New Zealand First secured, as part of its coalition agreement, the undoing of that. They say they want to refocus the curriculum on academic achievement, not ideology, including the removal and replacement of the gender, sexuality and relationship-based education guidelines. Do you think, though, again, to kind of my question about Section 7AA, do you think that kids are better off with those guidelines in place, perhaps with a review to make sure they're being implemented in a more uniform way or whatever, but do you think that kids are better off being aware and being having education that talks about inclusivity and awareness?
Sure. I think probably the piece of information that appears to be missing is, why were these things placed inside what was? We've had sexuality education for a long time in our education system. We as a country, the majority of us, have agreed that children at an age-appropriate level for them should know about their bodies, about keeping themselves safe. And if we go back and find out where that came from, it came actually out of some terrible things being done to children, and we needed children to know that they could keep themselves safe and to tell an adult and to be able to articulate it appropriately. So the part of the health and sexuality expansion of that curriculum has been around, first of all, the majority of the gender conversation inside there is actually still about trying to entrench in our society that there aren't men's roles and women's roles, there's just people's roles, and that anybody can do them. So, and there's a lot, as the Minister of Internal Affairs, I became very aware of the amount of pornography that our children are seeing. And so the internet was teaching our children what was normal with regard to sexual practice. And we need to counter that. So those were some of the drivers behind that curriculum. If that curriculum's not there and it's not delivered appropriately, then our children don't have a safe place to go to, because their parents, many of their parents, one, aren't aware of what they're being bombarded with, and two, aren't comfortable with these conversations.
Do you think that this government, that New Zealand First, perhaps is getting a bit too close to those imported culture wars?
It's probably, look, I'm no longer a member of New Zealand First, and that's because we're, how I view things and how New Zealand First views and represents things no longer match. So that's probably all I need to say about that.
Is your relationship with Winston Peters, do you still talk, or is that non-existent now?
Well, see, my relationship with Winston Peters was a working relationship. It was a very respectful one. You know, Winston has never been disrespectful of me, and I try very hard not to be disrespectful of him. And I saw him post negotiations for this government. It was a warm welcome. We caught up. He's mostly keen to make sure that my mum's in good health, because he highly rates her far more than he rates me. But you know, it's a friendly working relationship. So I don't have a lot of reason to contact Winston. He certainly doesn't have a lot of reason to contact me.
Yeah, your mum was the president of New Zealand First, wasn't she, for a very long time?
And the treasurer, party treasurer for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah. Would you ever go back to politics?
Well, you never say never, because otherwise you make yourself a hypocrite, right? Because the world works in mysterious ways. I never thought I would be a politician to start with. So never say never, not counting it out. I'm not dead yet.
Who would the party be then?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? At the moment, I am not a member of any political party, and I'm an observer like every other citizen.
Okay. Yeah. But do you lean more left or right?
Well, I think if you asked Winston, he would tell you I very much lean more from the centre to the left. Mm-hmm. Right? So he and I would balance each other out there slightly.
So have you had any conversations with the Labour Party yet then?
I have really good friends in the Labour Party, but I have friends in the National Party, and actually, Anna, you just heard me.
Some of my best friends are in the National Party.
But I mean, I worked with Brooke and David on making sure that we could get through some, you know, legislation, and I've worked with lots of people. So, I went and had a holiday with Annette King recently. So, you know, I'm in touch with lots of people.
Tracy, it's always a pleasure to speak to you, and I look forward to possibly seeing you around the halls of power again shortly.
I'm not sure about the halls of power, but I'll be on the streets of power. The power is actually in the vote.
Nice. Thank you so much, Tracy. Really wonderful to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Kia ora. Thank you.
We asked David Seymour why, as the sole MP of the ACT Party when the legislation passed, why did he give his support to it then? Why he didn't oppose it, given that others were raising the same concerns back then that he's now expressing, and why he's got a problem with it now? David Seymour replied, saying our position has changed to repealing Section 7AA because it has led to the reverse uplifts of vulnerable kids from loving homes based on their race. I think the responsibility of anyone in politics is to listen, reflect, and try make things better. It's not always the case that you can't change your mind when the facts change. Section 7AA has put Oranga Tamariki at odds with what should be its sole focus, protecting at-risk children. What's important now is fixing that. That was a statement from David Seymour. With the reintroduction of the Three Strikes Law this week, I thought it was a good opportunity to explain how the original architect of the legislation, former ACT MP David Garrett, became an unlikely pen pal of mine. Producer Chris is going to read David's bits and I'll read mine. The first email came in on September 7, 2023 at 9:43 a.m. Subject line...
How amusing.
The emails often conform to a similar format. A quote from an article I've recently written, followed by analysis of and feedback on said article or quote.
How amusing.
Was about a piece I'd published that morning revealing that the then Labor government was considering making a stalking offence punishable by imprisonment. The quote from my story.
That's why Labor is only doing this now and not during its 6 years in government.
Followed by the analysis.
You would never have written the above a year ago. Journalistic rats all abandoning the sinking ship. Too funny.
It would be 5 months until I replied to any emails from former ACT Party MP David Garrett. Over that time, I received a couple of emails, subject lines...
Resign and become an opinion writer.
And...
FW, never use words the meaning of which is uncertain to you.
Forwarded FW because he had been trying different email addresses for me until he landed on the right one. The offending word I had used was...
Eeked.
The quote David provided from my story.
In 2018, having eked out from the then Justice Minister Andrew Little that the government was planning to repeal the Three Strikes Law...
Followed by his analysis.
The meaning of the word eke is not to extract something from another person or entity.
And this time came a suggestion.
Dr. Google is your friend if you don't have an old-fashioned dictionary around. Instead of trying to be clever, you ought to have simply said, having extracted a commitment from then Justice Minister Andrew Little.
And an interesting insight.
My sources, which I suspect are at least as good or better than yours, tell me that what happened was not so much Winston Peters teaching Little a lesson, but rather that the then New Zealand First Caucus grew some cojones and told Peters that if he supported the repeal of a law that was one, once also New Zealand First policy, and two, was working exactly as intended, they would roll Peters as leader.
This was in reference to a story I did in 2018 when, during an interview with the then Justice Minister, Andrew Little, I eked out of him the government's plans to repeal three strikes in 2 weeks' time. And when the story went to air on the news that night, Winston Peters immediately killed off the prospect. Little hadn't yet taken a proposal to Cabinet and Peters was teaching Labor a lesson in not getting ahead of the process, something he's partly doing again now with Melissa Lee's media proposal. Note, the Cambridge Dictionary definition of eke something out is to obtain or win something only with difficulty or great effort. For example, the company expects to eke out a small profit this year. Little did not give up that information freely. It took great effort and questioning to obtain. The first email of David's I replied to was under the subject line,
I just choked coffee over my keyboard.
David was upping the ante. But the format remained the same. Story quote.
The same standards apply to governments of any stripe.
Analysis.
Do you really believe yourself when you write shit like the above? You are a disgrace to political editors who have gone before you, Miss O'Brien.
Signed.
Sincerely, David Garrett, SC.
My reply. Kia ora, David. Thanks for your email. Is this the same David Garrett charged with stealing the identity of a dead child to get a passport and who was suspended from the bar for making a false affidavit in court? If yes, it's been a while. Haven't seen you since the early three strikes days. Lovely to hear from you. Take care, Toba. His response?
Yep, the very same. The offence was committed 40 years ago now and 25 years before I became an MP. Of course, in your little nasty lefty mind, that is entirely morally equivalent to allegedly stealing $10,000 worth of gear while actually serving as an MP.
An apparent reference to Gowrie's Garamun. Followed by a correction from David.
Oh, and do get it right, honey. I was suspended for a year for swearing an affidavit that didn't disclose the whole truth.
All right, honey. And for the first time, credit was awarded to me as well.
Fair dues to you, though, referring to the dead child, he was 2.5, whose identity I used. It's normally the dead baby, which sounds much, much worse. What do you plan to do when stuff finally folds?
He asked by way of conclusion. My reply, lovely to hear from you, David. And his?
And why be a and tell me it's lovely to hear from me? But then I guess when you write lies and distortions for a living every day, truth and falsity become rather blurred.
Ouch, I just replied, all the best, David. I received more emails from David, one starting...
You will probably hit delete as soon as you see this message, but I will feel better writing it anyway.
He recommended a journalist I should look up if I had any interest in writing...
Truly disinterested...
political journalism, which David...
strongly suspected...
I did not. Another came in with the subject...
Another beautifully balanced piece on National and Luxon today.
But his sarcasm was double-edged...
At least your work is less error-ridden than your colleagues.
But any thoughts I might have been growing on David were premature. He quoted a piece I wrote when the devastating news came through that News Hub was being shut down.
I don't want to imagine New Zealand without News Hub.
David recommended that...
Given the above, may I respectfully suggest that you relocate as far away from New Zealand as possible. The bogs of Ireland surely beckon.
Signed.
Bon voyage. Sincerely, David Garrett, SC.
I didn't reply to that one. It was a bit mean. But 5 days later, David was back with a subject line.
Still here.
My reply. Hi, David. Are you bored? His.
Lol. Not at all. I have a huge capacity for work and I can touch type. So dashing off the odd, irreverent email is the work of only a minute or two.
Sending me straight back to earth, lest all this pen-palling was going to my head. David.
Like many others, I am observing the slow death of the mainstream media in this country with much interest and not a little schadenfreude.
David's latest email came in 2 weeks ago.
What's a zhuzh?
Was the subject. the quote from my story.
The updated logo will be used for anything new or when existing branding or signage needs replacing or a zhuzh.
His analysis and recommendation.
Dear Ms. O'Brien, when writing an email or Word document, you will find a wiggly red line under misspelled or non-existent words such as zhuzh. The good people at Microsoft have made it very easy for those of us who write for a living. We no longer have to even turn on spell check. The wiggly line appears automatically. It does, however, pay to proofread one's work before sending it, just in case you have missed the said red wiggly line. Do try harder. The journalism you produce is hard enough to read, even without glaring errors and non-existent words.
And like a smartass, I sent David a screenshot from the Oxford English Dictionary. Zhuzh, verb, to smarten up, someone or something. Which is when Waka Kotahi was planning to update branding as per the story quoted by David. In a minor conniption, David replied,
"Good Lord, I stand corrected and therefore must offer an apology. But I am prepared to bet that 95% of your readers were as clueless as me. Sincerely, David Garrett SC."
After months of correspondence and having endured a fair amount of criticism, I had finally eked out an apology from my unlikely pen friend. Each week we look at the winners and losers of the week that was in Snakes and Leaders before casting forward to the week ahead in Beehive Buzz. And normally Andrea Vance does the former and Luke Malpass the latter. This week Luke Stuff's political editor has all of our bases covered, looking both back and forward like some kind of wise political owl. G'day Luke.
Ow, wonderful.
Let's start with snakes and losers. A few losers of the week to traverse, but first, who was your winner?
Well, I think probably Christopher Luxon is the winner now. He is basically sacking Penny Simmons from Minister of Disability and Melissa Lee, Minister for Broadcasting. He's shunting them both outside of cabinet, essentially saying, you know, I'm here to get the job done. And they're going to be changing responsibilities, and we're going to be giving it to more. These things need to be dealt with by more senior ministers. So, and I think it's a winner for Luxon because he did say when he first came in, if people didn't perform, he would get rid of them, and he has done so. So there's not much going on in politics this week, and he's true to his word. So I think we can give him a winner on that one. The losers, pretty self-explanatory at this point.
Aforementioned ministers.
And it's pretty rough, really, because being Minister for Disability is a tough gig at the best of times. And it was never clear to me that Penny Simmons was sort of on top of really what was going on at the time. And Melissa Lee, well, you know, I mean, it was a bit of a shambles when she got it, and it still is a shambles. So
totally.
So that'd be the losers. So.
The writing was definitely on the wall, wasn't it, when the finance minister had to kind of step in, chastising Penny Simmons over those cuts for carers. And also with Melissa Lee, though, it's an interesting one because it's not all of her own making her undoing, because we know that Winston Peters in New Zealand First is sitting on that cabinet paper playing politics a little bit there as well. So she hasn't perhaps been able to progress things in the way that she would like. But you're 100% right. The Prime Minister decisive, doing as he says he would. And actually, I think with this kind of early reshuffle, showing himself to be more brutal than even John Key, and he was also a very decisive leader, and Jacinda Ardern when ministers flubbed up.
Oh, totally. And I think it will put a lot of other ministers on notice as well. Sort of shape up or you know, you'll be restructured out of there.
Now, if you take your Snakes and Leaders hat off and put your Beehive Buzz hat back on, this is going to, I mean, we've been in a 2-week recess with the school holidays anyway. It was always going to be a little bit frenetic when people come back to Parliament. Now it's going to be even more so, I think, isn't it, with the ousting of a couple of ministers. What else do we have to look forward to next week?
Well, I think there will be a considerable amount of political debate around that. I mean, despite the fact that Parliament hasn't been going, there have been a few things announced, not least of which was the three strikes law coming back on Monday. So there'll be a lot of debate around that. Obviously, Labor will try and really make hay with the fact that there's already been a reshuffle and basically a couple of ministers are being moved to outside of cabinet. And I suspect they'll be saying things very much along the lines of, well, if they're too useless to be in cabinet, why are they still ministers outside of cabinet? So I suspect we'll hear a fair bit of that rhetoric. And look, the other thing that we have to look forward to is James Shaw's valedictory.
That's right.
Anyone around the precinct is watching the Greens very carefully, because I think it would be fair to say there's a view that there's a reasonable chance that the Greens could sort of descend into some sort of civil war after Shaw leaves the building. So, and he's been a significant and important minister, and he's achieved a lot of things. So so I would really keep an eye out for that. And, you know, that will really mark a new chapter in the Green Party's evolution.
Yeah, much as Grant Robertson's did for the Labour Party. Thank you so much, Luke. Really appreciate your insights on this. It's going to be a huge week in politics. I look forward to seeing you in Parliament. I'll be down there.
That sounds awesome. Thanks so much, David.
See you, Lukey.
See ya.
I'm always interested to hear from you too. Email tova@stuff.co.nz. And producer Chris is here with some of your messages. Kia ora, Chris. How's it going?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good. Very, very well. Really enjoyed that chat with Tracy Martin today. I've always found her very candid and dispassionate in a good way, you know, very evidence-driven. So I'm having a good day.
Good. That's good. Good straight answers to good straight questions.
Yeah, always gratefully received by journalists. Have we had any good straight emails into the inbox this week?
We have indeed. Thank you. We've had plenty of comments on last week's pod, which focused on interest rates and mortgage misery, and highly serendipitous timing too, given the government's announcement on Sunday that it was going to be relaxing rules around borrowing. We had a long but fascinating and thought-provoking missive from financial mentor David Verrid. Too much to cover right now, but there are a few angles he suggested that we'll look at following up. David started actually by saying it was one of the most informative and in-depth reports on the issue he's come across.
Oh, thanks, David.
Yeah. Among his many points, he writes, going back a couple of years, financial mentors rarely saw people who had mortgages, but this has changed and most budget services will now have clients with this form of debt. It was also surprised that Chantal, one of the people you interviewed last week, was turned down for a Kiwi Saver hardship withdrawal for mortgage arrears. Had she been working, he says, with a financial mentor, that would certainly have been challenged. As you will be aware, Kiwi Saver hardship applications have skyrocketed in the last year or so. And that was actually a story that was covered on Stuff's Daily News podcast, Newsable, this week.
Yeah, check that out and follow them if you don't already. And you wanted to note as well, Chris, that David works with North Harbour Budgeting Services and Auckland Central Budgeting, and says that anyone with financial difficulties can call free financial helpline Money Talks to be put in touch with a financial mentor. The services are free, they're confidential, they're non-judgmental, and the Money Talks number is 0800 345 123. I did not know that was a service that existed. I wish I had, particularly me circa 10 years ago or yesterday.
Next up, Johnny, who asked why the Reserve Bank has been able to, quote, hide from cuts, presumably the public sector cuts that the government's instituting on a weekly basis. He writes, Governor Adrian Orr has paid more than $800,000 per annum to do what? Their workload has halved with the removal of unemployment from their mandate, and the average wage for their staff is more than $150,000 for a workforce that has grown from around 200 in 2017 to more than 400 now.
I suspect it's more nuanced than that with unemployment coming out of the mandate, but thank you for your email, Johnny. And we did invite Adrian Orr to appear on last week's podcast, and that remains an open invitation, Governor. Come on over.
And finally, for this week, Andrew in Kaikoura, a regular correspondent.
Hey, Andrew.
Passed on an opinion piece written by Abigail Disney and published by The Guardian. And yes, she is one of the Disneys, granddaughter of Roy O. Disney, who co-founded the company with his brother Walt. That must be gutting, you know. Like everybody's Walt. Who's heard of Roy O. Disney?
Yeah, that's Roy O. as well. That's catchy.
That's a tangent. Anyway, Andrew passed that on the back of the show a few weeks ago about limitarianism, the idea of society limiting how much wealth any individual can have. Abigail's piece noted that there are now almost 2,800 billionaires in the world, and their combined wealth is $14.2 trillion, which is up about 17% on the year before. And a trillion, Andrew reminds us, has 12 zeros.
Oh, my God.
Almost inconceivable.
It is. It is. Thank you, Andrew. I did read that opinion piece, and also the one about Abigail Disney and a bunch of other billionaires and wealthy people writing to Davos, the World Economic Forum, and saying, you know, take more money off us. This is not fair. Thank you very much, as always, for your emails and your feedback. Tova@stuff.co.nz is the address if you want to get in touch. You've been listening to Tova, hosted and produced by me, Tova O'Brien. You can follow us on Apple, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts to get the latest episode automatically, and keep an eye on your feed for bonus shortcasts. You can also listen at stuff.co.nz/Tova. Thanks as ever to audio editors extraordinaire Connor Scott and John Ropiha, to Jen Black and executive producer Chris Reed. Most of all, thank you for listening. A week is a long time in politics. Anything could happen. Two ministers could suddenly lose their jobs. Whatever comes next, we got you. Ka kite.
If you liked listening to this pod, help us make more like this. Visit stuff.co.nz/support.